Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, I'm George Chen.
And I'm Paco Romain.
And you're listening to SupDoc, the premier podcast about documentaries.
Today, we are recapping the 2019 Bob Dylan concert film, Rolling Thunder Review. Rolling Thunder Review is a Martin Scorsese mockumentary that is part Zelig, part This Is Spinal Tap, with actual concert footage and some unbelievable interviews with famous friends.
To quote Dylan himself, when somebody's wearing a mask, he's going to tell you the truth. When he's not wearing a mask, it's highly unlikely. That line speaks volumes about the movie itself, described by Netflix as part concert film, part fever dream, and an alchemic mix of fact and fantasy.
And our guest is comedian Tony Kameen, who started in the San Francisco comedy scene and is a big Dylan fan, so we thought he would be the perfect guest for this episode. Tony has appeared on Late Night with Conan O'Brien, Jimmy Kimmel Live, and Real Time with Bill Maher.
He's written for programs on NBC, VH1, and Comedy Central, in addition to being the co-creator of the Marijuana Logs. And now here's our talk with Tony.
Hey, everybody. We are discussing today, recapping Rolling Thunder, the documentary, quote-unquote, off Netflix. And there will be some spoilers, which you probably heard in the intro. But again, if you haven't seen this doc, you might... let's just say, listen to this podcast and then go watch it. I mean, whatever. You know? Right, George?
Yeah, I'd say it's a big
did
whatever.
You guys, now, you guys are documentary guys. Did you watch it without knowing, or did you watch it knowing?
First of all, that's the sultry voice of our guest today, comedian Tony Kameen.
I'm sorry.
Kameen.
Did
that's
you
all
watch
right, buddy.
It?
Yeah,
knowing?
That is. Ooh, that is sexy.
Or unknowing.
I watched it fully clothed, sir. I watched it unknowing. My buddy, Stephen Lynch, texted me and said, "Hey, have you seen Rolling Thunder?" I'm like, "The documentary about my butt?" Because I thought that was funny. And then he was like, "No." And then I was like, "What are you talking about?" And he's like, "The Bob Dylan doc." So I watch it. And then he's like, "Read about it afterwards."
I just got that joke.
Oh.
Stephen Lynch. I don't know. He's a piano guy, right?
Yeah, music guy. Guitar guy. Yeah.
I know Ron Lynch.
I watched it.
Ron Lynch.
And then I looked it up. What about you guys?
Oh, someone told me that it was fake, and then I just assumed like a bunch of stuff was green screened. I thought that's what they meant. Like, I thought that Rolling Thunder
is
review,
this a bad way to start this? Sorry, I just jumped in. But it's like kind of gives you context to how it comes to you originally, you know, like, because I am a Dylan fan, I didn't know. But I also, when I found out, was 100% makes perfect sense. Like it didn't change my opinion of the thing at all, because I was kind of like, what? I almost kind of maybe was thinking it was like, come on. Like, I don't, you know, like the Sharon Stone part. I was just like, you would have heard of this by now.
Yeah, she's too,
you know,
young.
Like,
yeah.
You're just hearing this now. She's been famous all this time, you know, like, mm-hmm.
Something smells.
Yeah. And even like Bob Dylan's such a hard, it's, you never 100% sure what you get. Look at that Todd Haynes movie. I didn't know about that going in. And I was like, what is going on? That was even weirder to me, you know? I think it's interesting. It's a lot of big questions coming up, but I just think how you first see it kind of matters.
Okay. So you two had no idea initially.
No.
I was given overly prepped. So I just thought a bunch of stuff was like CGI.
What's overly, like 2 years of prepped? Like what's over
like
prepped?
It's like I have to watch this for the podcast.
Okay, so you're just doing your homework for
I'm just doing my homework. And So I didn't know if Rolling Thunder Review was actually a tour or not.
Okay, you didn't know what level.
Yeah, I didn't know what level of made up it was.
The whole thing could be.
I was like, are they overdubbing? Is Allen Ginsberg like CGI? Like it's a Pixar Allen Ginsberg? I thought that was happening.
That would be the worst Pixar movie
ever. Yeah, what a weird thing to do. It's just like, because it was his beard. I'm like, it's going in and out of focus. Are they like making different words for, is someone doing Ginsberg right now?
At times it borderlies on cliche too. That's why you think, is this a characterization of him? Because like David Cross played him so good.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I kept thinking, this is almost like a Cross character. It was a perfect casting because he seems like a Cross character.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, it's always his shoes off, Indian style.
So Jewish, so New York.
Yeah.
So there's an article that explains everything that's fake. Did you guys read that article?
Yes. No, I didn't read that article, okay. But...
Paco's read it, so he can break us down.
I would just imagine, you can kind of tell. I mean, I would imagine there's some things maybe I'd be surprised about, but I would say any of the celebrities saying they were there, the filmmaker thing you could tell was, you know, that's... Come on, this guy. You would have just heard about this by now.
Is that guy not real? Because someone is filming, right?
That's Bette Midler's husband. He's a notorious like prankster actor guy.
Okay, so we don't know who was filming. Okay, so that was all. Okay, so they kind of, he seemed a little young to be that guy. Yeah. But then Joan Baez,
he would have been very young. Yeah.
Joan Baez looks like pretty much the same. Yeah. So that was surprising. Also, like I knew vaguely about their relationship, but they really get into some stuff in that, like the lot of regret there, I think.
Well, the like you know that never Bob Dylan was the early one of my mom liked Bob Dylan instead of the Beatles, so I got Bob Dylan early, and this is the era I came into Bob Dylan, the Desire album, which I think is right after Blood on the Tracks. I think this is around Blood on the Tracks era, and I just took to it. Like Hurricane was the song, you know, and it's a pretty easy song to like. It's very basic. And you get into the weirder stuff and you kind of, okay, then you're like the Idiot Win and the things that are harder to swallow for a young teenager. And you get it and it's like, and you go back and the stuff kind of sounds not simple, but you know, like Blown in the Wind is not, is, you know, compared to like Hurricane or Idiot Win is, there's a lot of growth there. and then you just realize, oh, there's all these phases once you dip your world into Dylan, someone's always disappointed in him. He's always changing, you know, and the more you get to read about him personally, that's always like disappointing too, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like in the Don't Look Back documentary, how he's just like sexist and like not very funny, you know?
Yeah. Did you like Don't Look Back?
Yeah. I loved it. I thought it was great, you know?
And... So to put a little,
if you can separate the guy from, you know, like as a work, I thought it was amazing.
Right. You know? I thought I was very confused by it. I am everything Bob Dylan has ever done. I'm confused. The man just confuses me.
Yes.
To put a little context, I don't know, maybe let's say 6, 7, 8 months ago on Facebook, I was like, someone help me. I don't like Bob Dylan. I don't understand what's happening. I feel like I should know a little bit about this guy. I feel like I should know his music. And you helped me. You got on Facebook and you said, oh, you should check this out. Because I was going to go to Amoeba and spend $100 on Bob Dylan music. That was the thing. And then
right, and that could go horribly wrong, you know.
And it kind of did, and it kind of didn't. There was some stuff I really enjoyed. One More Cup of Coffee is like one of my favorite songs now. I love that tune. And there was some like some stuff that you never hear on the radio. Some weird tracks that he did in the like late 60s, early 70s that I thought was awesome. But ultimately, I feel like I'm always confused by this guy. Have you ever seen him live?
Yeah, I've seen him like 4 times. And I say, last, like the third time, I'm like, eh, never again. and then, what? You know, he played, when I lived in New York, he played Prospect Park, like very close to my house. And it was, you know, it's like he's such a different thing, you know, than when I saw him. My first time my mom took me for my birthday, because she knew I was a fan. It was probably maybe a few years after this era. Uh-huh. It was when he had like his Vegas-y era. It was the Street Legal was the album, which is not, I don't recommend it. You know, I have a fondness for it now personally, but like it was a weird era after this, after like Blood on the Tracks and Desire, kind of like a schmaltzier area. Mm-hmm. You know, he had like a horn section, I think maybe even for a bit of it, and 3 backup singers. It was, and that was so different than the next time I saw him. He had gone religious.
Oh, right.
At the Warfield Theater. So we had, I had these great seats. I was so psyched to see Bob Dylan in this relatively small place, the Warfield. And it's just like all this religious stuff. It was interesting.
You grew up in the Bay Area?
Yeah,
then?
Yeah. Outside okay. of Santa, Mountain View.
Yeah. Because that was before the shoreline or anything.
Yeah. That was before the shoreline was built. Like in the 80s, I think.
I remember going to the shoreline in the 80s. Yeah. It's the first time.
I remember hearing the first concert at my from my family home. It was like Iglesias, Julio Iglesias.
Hey, you can never go wrong with Julio Iglesias.
Yeah, and my mom was like, "Is that what are we? What's that sound?" I'm like, "I think it's Julio Iglesias."
Light my fire. Yeah. Did you little factoid? If you look at aerial views of Shoreline Amphitheater, it is the Deadhead. It's the Dead logo.
Oh,
yeah.
I did not know that.
Molly Schmink, our friend from San Francisco, had the Grateful Dead had a lot of input into the design of that place. I guess that was supposed to be their home away from home, their sort of place. And I guess it still kind of is. They play there with the new incarnation of Dead & Company every summer. They just were there.
NASA.
Yeah, so and backstage there's stuff. There's all this stuff dedicated to them and like Jerry's Corner and stuff. So they have a very strong presence there.
Hmm. Have you performed there?
Just during that Oddball Festival.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's great.
Just in front of 10,000 people?
Yeah, in my hometown.
Yeah, just shirk it off. You said it so like it was.
I was surprised at how fun it was because you know comedy outdoors. You've probably done comedy today. It's always like it's more of fun to say you did it than this is the way maybe because the bowl is shaped or something. Like you heard the laughs and it was like wow, this is fun actually. You know.
Yeah.
So I was surprised. You know because
I went to
comedy days. Oh, you did? Did you do it?
I didn't perform in it. No, I was there in the audience. Yeah. Sarah Silverman, Mark Maron, Jim Gaffigan, yourself, other people.
Yeah, that was a better year.
Did it more than once?
I thought it was just once. I think they did like two or three years.
Yeah, yeah.
Then they ran out of oddballs.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right.
All these are even balls, so,
So you turned me on to you gave me a lot of titles, a lot of songs to go listen to. I for like a week, all I listened to was Bob Dylan, and I still was just as confused. The guy is like a little lizard. I feel like he just changes colors all the time.
Are you saying maybe like a chameleon?
Maybe.
But I mean, there's like the Nashville skyline where he has a whole different voice than like lay 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 like this is the same guy it's just like it is confusing to be a Bob Dylan fan because you have to just like sign up for all his changes
that's funny.
I'm on board. He's gonna go to Christian. Yep, me too. It has to be, if not disappointing, challenging at least.
Right. Do you think Bob is like a visionary, or is he somebody that is like has self-esteem problems and is always trying to change to like find his audience? Or does that make sense?
To find his audience?
I don't think he tries to find an audience. I think he's a musician who just like wants to play music and whatever. I think earlier on, like when you listen to his things, he's like, I could just write songs so fast and they just come to me now. I can't do that, but I play my band's tighter, and I could find different meanings to the songs. I'm doing that now, so it's just like, I think it's just an artist doing what he wants to do, and all good artists, they all the best ones have phases. Like Woody Allen has a silly phase, and he got too serious, and then he found a balance or whatever. And Bob Dylan, the Beatles, you have phase, and the Who, many
the Wallflowers,
the Wallflowers. Maybe besides like there's then those like the Ramones who just did one thing awesome.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like and sometimes audiences shift depending on the phases. I'm a big Radiohead fan and they've certainly done that too over the years, with OK Computer and then Kid A. And I think good comics do that. I don't do that. I'm serious. But I'm like, you could say, remember when they were in that phase or mm-hmm. doing like that, they told smaller jokes, then they told longer jokes, and they're storytellers, whatever.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think it's just an artist's path, if you will,
You're more of a Rambling Jack Elliott of comedy.
I'm more of the Rambling Jack. Yeah, I'm around, I'm a good time, but no one's going to buy my album.
Did you hear about the Radiohead... Rolling Head was a band in my hometown. Radiohead, someone took their mini disc player, Did you hear about this?
No. Yeah. And they put it out. Was it a bootleg?
Yeah,
that was.
Well, the stuff where they just released all that music to
just
to,
recently. Someone,
yeah, some hackers who were blackmailing them said, "We're going to release 36 hours of these outtakes from OK Computer." And they just said, "Oh, we'll just release it."
We'll preempt we'll you.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. I got to admire. I think that's admirable.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Get in front of it.
I think that's awesome. They're like, fuck you. This is what we're going to. It's like when you get that email. It's like, I've taken over your computer and I've seen you masturbating. And if you don't pay me $1 million, I'm going to release it to you. And I'm like, yeah, fuck, go ahead.
First of all, I'm sorry for you had to see that. I always said that. Like, go ahead.
The weird German shit I watch.
These Nigerian princes love to watch me jerk off.
Yeah, it's just like, come on, go for it, dude. Yeah.
So that's the part about, so again, this documentary for me, or is it a mockumentary?
Should we call it? Yeah, I was going to say, should we call it a documentary? I didn't think.
Well, it's also like, you know, like concert films are documentaries technically because they're documenting an event. But it's a different, it's kind of an umbrella term now, especially since this is a golden era of documentaries. So there's these things that kind of sneak in through the edge. Was the Joaquin Phoenix thing a prank or was it a documentary or both? Because it did happen, but it was you know ginned up to happen. So it's like a prank. It's the gray area. I think everything is cool. You know, it's just like I think it's kind of funny they did this. You know.
Yeah, I think they kind of tipped their hand a lot with the setup, like the opening scene. It's like, look at the history of cinema.
Yeah.
Like, look, there is not a woman behind the thing. I'm like, that led me to believe. That's what made me think everything was CGI in this. Like that setup.
And I just think it's like, you know, you're these guys, you're legends, and you want to put out this bookmark, the benchmark of time. Well, I think it's just kind of like a fun, interesting way to do it. They both have done everything. It's like,
well, Scorsese, too, is what I'm talking about. Yeah, which we didn't really get into yet too much.
So you're like, are you just going to put this out? I mean, and I was surprised about how good some of the songs were. Like, this is a kind of a scrappy era, but like, man, he's, that Hurricane and it's amazing. There's some really tight stuff on there. And there's some, a good example of, like challenging stuff, like his version of this is of Hattie Carroll. I don't know if you fans. It's kind of just like this honky tonk fast version. I think doesn't do it any favors. Mm-hmm. And that's just typical Dylan concert. You're gonna get something. It takes you a while to. Oh, that's Rolling Stone, and then the arrangements are all over the place. You know, and some are great if you like them, and then some are like, that seemed to butcher.
I think the performances.
Have you ever seen them? Or are you?
I've never seen them. I wouldn't say I'm like a big fan. I'm like have a passing knowledge of him, but like you know, like I knew like the hit songs, obviously.
Right.
But no, I mean, I thought you know the people talk about his charisma and his sort of stage presence, and I think the white makeup has to help a little bit. I got some good screen caps of him just like. Him and Roger McGinn at the end, where he's just like looks like a crazy like preacher man or something, you know. This had a very like revival, like you know, religious folk revival vibe to it, I guess.
Yeah, and as a comic, or a performer, you could see the idea of bringing all your friends, having this gang along to this tour. It sounds like it'd be fun, you know, like a fun idea.
Yeah, including your ex. Yeah.
Because I never thought he was that great when I've seen him live. Not, you know, it's just a guy standing there playing his songs. He's not like a brilliant guitar player. He's a great songwriter. So it depends, sort of depending on the band he's with and the mood he's in. You know, because you say, oh, he's got a lot of charisma. It's hard to sort of tell because he's kind of barking into this thing. It's a fluffy mop of head. And you go see bands like The Who and they're jumping all over the place, and I don't know if I'd say he's like a great live player, but there's certain things you can appreciate, you know, when you see him. You
well,
know?
That's like why it works as a film, because like if we're standing like in the back of even a 3,000 seat room, you're standing at the back. It's like going to see him at the Great American Music Hall or something.
Which would be
amazing to see, but you like the film, the camera.
And that's him being very good, like with the white face. That's him like. Putting it out there
effort.
As opposed to like standing behind an organ is that, like I think that's him. That's how it's been maybe last. But then you always hear someone's like, "Oh, I caught one." You know, I caught a show that was he played guitar. He came out and he was on. He took some leads.
Yeah.
So once in a while you hear a show is really great, but mostly it's like, yeah, you know, he kind of grumbles through them.
He's never gone full didgeridoo or anything like that. Yeah.
No. Go ahead.
I was. For me, the most intense thing about this documentary was the end that shows his fucking concert tours for the last 40
years.
Yeah,
yeah. He's never gone off the... It's crazy. Like,
that's insanity.
He plays... Like, I read the story where he played, you know, during the Wallflower when they were popular. They played the same festival and they didn't even meet because one he was on earlier in the day and Bob Dylan had another show to go to. You know, like, he had, like... He has this tight little band, and he just doesn't stop touring. And there's something to be said for that. Like, he's pushing, what, 80 or something like that, you know? And he has a family, I guess. He travels around in an RV sometimes with and tries to be a normal family man, you know?
Jim Gaffigan style.
But it's also so weird, like, his love life. Like, he is married to his backup singer that no one knew about, you know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really an odd cat.
Or was he?
Or was he? You know, who knows?
Did he really have a backup singer?
Is Jacob Dylan his son?
He has this little family, and he's it's just an odd guy, you know? It's just like...
Well, in the documentary, it tells about how he took a long break. He'd stopped touring. He took, like, what, 8 years off or something like that. Or he had a motorcycle accident, right?
Yeah. Which was, people say it was a heroin addiction. He was trying to kick a heroin addiction, and that's the motorcycle accident's often in quotes.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
So that's like the official story, but there's a lot of conspiracy theorists that like the motorcycle accident.
Yeah, that's like me and carbs. I've had a motorcycle accident. Apparently, I had it's more of a scooter. I think if it's carbs versus heroin, it's more of a scooter accident.
More scooter, yeah.
By the way, it leads to a needle.
Well, yeah. that was another question I was getting into.
Actually,
like, I don't know any of the
probably kill more people than heroin. Yeah, right.
It was a carb accident.
I don't know any of the nefarious Bob Dylan stuff. It's not really well known. Like, did he drink? Did he smoke pot? Apparently, he did heroin. Like, that's kind of the stuff I don't know.
And
about.
That's just like, I don't even know if that's true or what. That was the rumor of he took like 68, 69, went up to Woodstock and just kind of retreated for a while. And it's got to be odd to be. When you're just like hailed, you know, the Beatles at least had each other and stuff. When you're that big and like, oh, you're the next Messiah, it's got to screw with your head, you know?
I know. Let's write a movie where everyone forgets that Bob Dylan wrote songs. And then one guy is like, I'm going to sing about a boxer who was imprisoned in the 60s, 70s. And people are like, it's 2019. Why are you talking about this guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. This is an odd timing for this. I mean, a lot of work went into this for like just a wink and a nod to an audience.
They could have just put concert footage out and it would have been a strong thing, you know, but they put this hoodwink little prank.
Yeah, like it took like Scorsese being involved for this to get finalized, I guess. I don't know. Like having those two, like, I don't know what their relationship is like. That seems like that's a weird room to be in. Where it's Dylan and Scorsese.
Well, I know Scorsese was roommates with Robbie Robertson, and that's why The Last Waltz happened, or part of the reasons, I think. So I think maybe it's a transference in there. They probably obviously met during The Last Waltz.
Yeah.
So they have a relationship.
What a weird roommate to have. Like, my roommate Marty, he eats all my
Who
cereal.
Took my cheese? I had cheese in there. Who took my cheese? Someone took my cheese. Come on. Beautiful cheese. I had holes. It was beautiful.
I set up a
that's
security
the first time
camera.
I attempted that.
That's good. Very good. It's a bit.
Very good.
Yeah. It's
got
a
these
bit.
Bushy eyebrows.
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
I think that's a character you should do.
Good. All right.
Do a beard and then, yeah.
Oh, I can't wait.
We got a bit. Yep. We got a bit
Look
here,
out.
Folks.
I'm going to debut at the Punchline in 2 weeks.
Nice. Well, hopefully it'll be open. Oh, that's inside.
By the
inside.
Time. This,
yeah. It's
well,
going
to
be open.
This is airing very soon. So it's open as of right now. Go to the Punchline.
Amen.
If you can. Yeah.
They were supposed to be meaner to each other. I listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We're like the doughboys of
the doughy boys.
We're just the doughy. There you go. We're just
the carbs.
Doughy.
That's where
we
the carbs
just sit indoors
went.
And watch movies.
Yeah. So much. I'm so pale. But you're
an active guy. You play basketball and
I
stuff.
Like,
you get out there.
My basketball.
You're always
yeah.
out and about. I think
I do nothing.
True.
I walked,
do nothing.
I walked to Thai food yesterday. That's what
see,
I
but
did.
You walked. You didn't Postmates it.
Oh, that's true. I did get out of the house for that. That's true.
Did you go to that one restaurant by your house that we went to?
Rune Pair? No, I went in the same plaza. I went to the other one. It's called Thai Patio. This is a great Thai food neighborhood if you...
It should be Pad Tidio.
It should be Pad Tidio. Yeah.
Sorry, business. Just kidding. This is the neighborhood to live in if you're...
You know what we're right by? Did you watch I Am the Night? Do you know about that
No.
thing? The podcast that's The Root of Evil. the guy who they think is the Black Dahlia murderer lives right
oh, really?
At the corner. He's not alive anymore.
He's not currently.
I was gonna say,
there.
Let's go get him.
Yeah. The Hodel, George Hodel.
If we
house.
Got him, this podcast would get a lot of hits.
Oh my God.
We should just put that in the show notes.
Karen Kilgariff would be so mad at me.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, I should.
She's probably mad at me anyway.
Yeah, she doesn't write me back. Yeah. We live right. This is a neighborhood of Thai food and murder houses.
But also, half like everybody in the UCB lives in this neighborhood, right?
Oh yeah, Ron Lynch lives kind of up the street.
He's not UCB.
Okay, he lives by UCB.
I know Ron. He was my old roommate in San Francisco.
Oh, did you live in that condo?
I lived in that house with Ron Lynch and Chris Hobbs. Yeah,
Paco, have you been to that condo?
I had the good room. I had the good room.
I've only heard Dana Gould, Dan Spencer. I've heard legendary stories about that fucking place. I wish.
Yeah, I had Dana's room.
Mm-hmm. You had Dana's room?
I got Dana's room, which was the best room. It had the bay windows. It had a fireplace, and it was nice.
That was on Clement Street in San Francisco?
It was on 21st between Geary and Clement.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a nice neighborhood. I mean, that's a delicious neighborhood.
So that's like near Holy City Zoo, right?
Yeah,
like
it was. That's the reason it was there, mm-hmm. is the zoo is on 6th down the street. It was, you know, like 10-minute walk.
Was that your era of San Francisco comedy?
I got the end of the zoo, so it wasn't. There was predecessors who had the real time to make money on the road. I got into it just as it was dying. Probably not a coincidence. I'm probably a symptom. I'm sure, you know. I got
on
the last things of evening at the Improv. I caught the last dying wave of those shows. You know.
Yeah.
Timing is everything.
Ron actually showed me in San Francisco where the old Improv was. It's just like a blues club.
It's the Biscuit and Blues. Yeah. And that was such a great club. It had the classic setup of underground. You know, low ceiling, just like that's those good clubs always have those low ceilings, dark, not that nice. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the Improvs, but they're all kind of like nice. They're all a little too.
They are nice.
They can
People want nice though now. They don't want too dingy.
Yeah, that's true. You don't have to be too dingy. Like Punchline's a great, perfect balance. You did the Comedy Works. That's perfect.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Right? That's a great. They start below you, and then the audience slowly is raked up. It's like your eyesight's right in the middle of the crowd. It's so good.
It's a really a perfect club. Yeah, it was awesome to be there and to see it for the first time, and to perform.
Yeah, Tony, have you opened for musicians before? Because I was thinking about how Ginsberg would just go up there like, you had 5 minutes, you got 2 minutes now. And then eventually he's just loading gear at the end of the tour. Like, what is it like to... I've done it a little bit, like opening for a musician, but have you had a lot of experience doing that? Like being
just a little bit. I used to do the old Ironsides in Sacramento. We used to do, like, they'd have a whole day of music and we'd do the banter in between. So that's not because they expect it. It's not the same thing. I've been offered to do this offshoot of the Hold Steady. The guy asked it, and I was like, I don't want to do it.
Open for the Hold Steady?
Yeah. That was an offshoot. The guy is a musician. Okay, yeah. He's in this other band. The mm-hmm. keyboard player who had the crazy mustache, mm-hmm. Hans. He's like, I have this thing, and then he's like, maybe the Hold. I think he asked for the Hold Steady too. Some club shows in New York at the time. And I said, I don't know. I don't think I'd want to do it. But I've done the High Times Award where there's bands on stage and you're kind of, unless you're the focus. I mean, it's hard enough to do comedy when you're the focus. you know, people right. are still distracted. But when it's like, we want to see the bands. So I don't have tons of experience, mm-hmm. but it doesn't sound great. They're called like band breaks, you know?
Yeah. I remember like when hearing that like Brian Copeland used to like open for people, like musicians on tour and stuff like that. Paco, have you opened for musicians as a comic?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's the worst. It's so bad. Because
I would think someplace like, you know, like Molly asked me, oh, do you want to do, it was some jazzy, like at Paul Masson Winery. I think that's a different thing than a club. Like that might be still not a good gig, but still like maybe, you know, like, oh, they're going to see Jean-Luc Ponty or something.
Yeah. Jean-Luc Ponty, yeah.
I'll do my French jokes. But like, you know what I mean? Like it's like a wine crowd, but still they're not there to see you. So you're going to probably offend. It's not.
But they're
not
going to yell at you, though.
They're not going to yell at you. They might be, you know.
The worst is you get some polite applause and they're not listening. You know,
that's yeah.
But I used to open for bands at the Parkside here.
Oh,
in
I love the Parkside. Yeah,
and
great.
Bottom
place.
Of the Hill. For a while, when I first started, they were doing they were having comics to go between bands so that during their, you know, when their band, the next band was setting up. It was, and it was horrible.
Like, yeah, because I'll hit a snare drum while you're talking.
Oh, dude. And nobody cares. And the volume change between like, good night. And then I'm like, hey, man, buses are weird. You know, like, just that. Yeah,
you
know,
there's
change.
A throng of people headed face the bathroom and bar as you come on stage because it's the band's taking a break. That's the time not to pay attention.
Yeah.
Right. After you just paid attention.
Yeah. They just think you're like,
you ever notice? You're like, no, I don't notice. Yeah. They don't care.
Now imagine that you're like trying to be like, I saw the greatest minds of my generation. Like, and then Steve Aoki, you know, that would be like Allen Ginsberg opening for a dubstep DJ or something.
That was very sad though. In that doc, I'm watching Allen Ginsberg trying to get like at least 5 minutes on stage at some point, and then they like cut him down to two.
I get it.
You get a one minute light.
I don't want to see fucking Allen Ginsberg if I'm going to a Bob Dylan show. And I'm even going to Bob Dylan. You know, I don't want to see Allen Ginsberg if I'm going to Allen Ginsberg show.
I've seen Allen Ginsberg. I haven't seen Dylan, but I did see Ginsberg when I was like, in high school. I guess so. I mean, I vaguely knew about him because my grandfather was super Republican, but he had some like conservative magazine where like a super right wing guy was interviewing Ginsberg just to be kind of like, look at this weirdo. And I'm just like, yeah, well, everything he's saying makes a lot more sense than the other guy. So I found out about Ginsberg through that. And then, yeah, he did a thing at San Jose State right before it might have been a year or two before he died. Yeah.
I imagine it's pretty similar to see like Henry Rollins is seeing Allen Ginsberg. It's
kind of I actually enjoyed seeing Henry Rollins, but
he'd be intense. The time I saw him, it was kind of homophobic, but
Rollins.
Yeah, it was. This was like late '80s though. I was a KFJC person. Yeah. So.
Oh, did you work at KFJC?
Yeah, yeah.
You did a radio show.
Uh huh. Saturday noon to three. It was a great slot.
What kind of stuff were you playing back
like
then?
Like pop, like punk pop ish stuff. You know. I interviewed comics.
80 in the 80s?
84, 85, okay. 86. Like
I have a friend who's there now, and I sent him a comedy thing to try to get him to play it on air. But it'd be fun to like do comedy. Just you had comics, you did like banter.
Yeah,
like,
I did interviewed comics. I called it the Bomb Shelter, and we had Jake Johansson. We had, you know, the local. I would just go to San Francisco and ask people, because I was just starting. I hadn't even started yet. I think Kevin Kataoka, comic from San Francisco, was like, hey, I do. There's this place to go. He was a KFJC member. He's like, there's a club called the Holy City Zoo. You should. And him and Don Perazzo were doing it already. So I went up with them one night. I'm like, oh, and, you know, checked it out and stuff. And it was, I could not believe how funny it was. You know, like these guys, Lankin Earl.
Oh, yeah.
And Bob Rubin, you know, where you're just like.
I know Bob Rubin,
I didn't even know this existed. You know, because I was a music guy. I go to bands and stuff. So I was like, whoa, this is great. This stuff. And I had just broken up with this longtime girlfriend. So I was like laughing my heart out. And I was like, oh, this is healthy. You know, as opposed to like drinking or whatever.
Yeah. Did you go to Foothill College or you just did the thing? Okay.
Yeah. Can't you tell by my grammar?
So for people who don't know what KFSG is or what are you guys KFJC
is a
Wave of the West
is a alternative radio station at Foothill College, and it had a pretty big scope at that time because there was no, it was before Live 105 started. It was like the punk station. I interviewed The Edge, and so it was kind of a prominent station for rock music.
It's kind of like the West Coast version of WFMU.
Yeah, exactly. Probably. When I talked to Tom Sharpling, he's like, oh, that's actually a station we like, you know. And
the one station.
Yeah.
He doesn't even like FMU anymore. Yeah.
He left, right? Yeah.
We did that documentary, actually. Yeah.
So, Tony, who did you come up with? Is Patton in your generation? Like, who are the comics in San Francisco scene that you came up with?
I'd say Kevin Kataoka, Lori Kilmartin had been doing it. Karen Anderson had been doing it. Greg Barrett started a little after me. Margaret Cho a little after me. Chris Hobbs, who doesn't really do a con, but he was in there ahead of me. But people I hung out with was Alex Reed, who's still friends with. He's a director now, TV director.
Capurro?
Scott Capurro started after us. He was a different scene, and he came over into the mainstream scene after the clubs. And then the people who've been around for a long time, you know, like Doug Ferrari and all those other guys were already established. Mike Guido, Stephen Pearl was a legend, you know.
I was about to ask you, like, who did you look up to in that scene?
I really liked Jake Johansson was my favorite at the time.
Me too.
He wouldn't really hang out at the zoo too much because he was working a lot. But like, I just liked. I was like a Bob Newhart fan. I liked the guys who didn't have the super strong cell, you know, and kind of were. But then I also loved Lankin Earl, who were ridiculous, you know.
See, I don't know much about Lake. Can you describe what their act was?
There's a YouTube.
It's like dark and awkward.
There's a very good YouTube. I've tried to look for stuff of theirs on YouTube.
Yeah, that's the best example.
There's a gun bit.
There's just like really, one guy was a straight guy. Sometimes they're both the straight guy. I look them up. It's hard to describe. It's dark and...
they're around and
they still work together? They still do stuff here. And they both still write on a lot of stuff. I think, but they may do National Lampoon. And I think Jim works on Jimmy Dore's podcast.
Okay. I think I saw them do something together at Ron's show at the tomorrow.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. But super funny guys, boy. Both of them.
That's a duo that I've just started hearing about. I know they're legendary and I have no idea what they did. Like, I have zero idea.
Yeah, try to YouTube. It's just kind of ahead of its time, awkward humor, you know, yeah. I guess. That's the best way to put it.
Super dark, yeah.
Yeah.
Wayne Fetterman has a great podcast called The History of Stand-Up, and they just did a Holy City Zoo episode.
Oh.
And they talk about those guys, and they talk about every, you know, Ellen DeGeneres and Paula Poundstone. They go through kind of the history of all that. So
that a lot of the greats are some of the people who signed up for the open mics, like Jackie Sachs and Garrick Mann, who are just like odd, so odd that they'd never really be comedians, but they liked, that was their hobby. You know, maybe I think they might have had some handicaps or some disabilities. This guy was like a heroin addict, and he would come out of the park and he would sign up, and he said he'd like to go to the zoo because it was warm, because, you know, it's freezing neighborhood.
Right.
So when he called his name, he would get up and try stuff like, "Hey, you have a Fulton Avenue? What? You know, just like ramble and then go back to the back of the club and then sleep till they kicked him out." But it kind of was the part of the magic of the place, because San Francisco at the time still had a lot of weirdo. Now I guess a lot of it's been flushed away, but you know, it would kind of made it fun because that's the stuff you don't see once you start working. You see a lot less of the fringe weirdos that made it special.
Okay, for two things, because I just started watching that amazing Jonathan documentary.
Oh, yeah.
He was part of that scene as well.
Yeah.
Were you around?
I never saw. He'd already left before. Yeah.
And then I run an open mic in Echo Park at a library, so there's no barrier to entry.
Mm.
There's a homeless lady who went on the other day, and she had a baby squirrel in her bra that she'd gotten, like a living baby squirrel someone had given her the day before. And she was like, "I spent my last $50 on puppy food for this baby squirrel." I'm just like, that is not something you'd see at any mic where there is a drink minimum. You know what I'm saying?
No.
What's the punchline? You're like, "There's no punchline, ma'am." kind of like that. And I love open mics, except for sometimes you sign up and you're just way in there like, "This is ridiculous."
Yeah.
Sometimes they're depressing. But if there's enough colorful people, they make it worth doing, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's just, like you said, you don't see it. Even at showcases, it's been already weeded out, you know, and sometimes that stuff is magical.
Oh, I just went to the Comedy Store Monday potluck for the first time, and I was watching people, you know, I'd never seen before. And the one guy came in, and he was homeless, and his whole act was about how great he's doing as a homeless guy, you know.
Did it work?
Yeah, he went pretty well.
Oh, good. Him.
Yeah.
Good for him.
This ties into Rolling Thunder in some way, right? I feel like it kind of does.
Because
there's no
does.
Documentation of it.
It's just because of urban legend. People, it's part of that like mask trickery stuff of the entertainment business. I kind of feel like if there's a theme to this documentary, Rolling Thunder, it's kind of like, you know, the like voila idea of entertainment. It's like anything can be entertainment. It can be like a straight concert video, or it can be like a mockumentary. I mean, this was like Zelig meets This Is Spinal Tap, you know, like that's.
I was listening to an interview on KPCC they did with the producer and the editor of this, and they talk about how having that character Ratso, the Rolling Stone writer, was like this arc. They talked about it in terms of archetypes too. So it's interesting you bring up archetypes. So yeah, they're kind of getting at this sort of how many like kind of mythical godlike characters were hanging out on that tour.
Right.
Like, we didn't even talk about Joni Mitchell yet. I mean, which is like, I wanted like a whole thing about that.
That was crazy. I guess it's in Gordon Lightfoot's apartment and just start I think that's,
she's showing them her song "Coyote" that hadn't been played.
Yeah,
and that's one of the best Joni Mitchell songs. Yeah,
famous song. You know, And it's like that, and that, like the Patti Smith scene where it's like,
oh, yeah.
I was like, wait, but this isn't that good though, is it? You know, that's what I kept. Like, is this where it gains into play? Like, because Joni Mitchell does this amazing thing. You know, mm-hmm. You're like, wow, this is like how you picture artists hanging out. Like, hey, I have this new song.
Yeah, you want to jam on it?
Check out my new painting, you know, and it's like Playboy After Dark kind of strive to do. Like, we're having a cocktail party, and everyone's really talented, and they're going to be sharing their talents. Mm-hmm. But then it's like, oh, this is where my air into pretense is when Patti Smith does that poem. I don't know if that was bad or good. I don't know poetry, but I was like, I don't know.
Yeah, I found like there's another poet who ends up being a roadie on this tour as well. Blanking out his name, like Obelsky or something. But yeah, I'm not a. The idea of doing a show with a bunch of musicians and then poets in between, like, it's a hard sell for me, even with Ginsberg.
You know? It's like when someone does an announcement at a benefit, you know, it's like, no matter how bad, it's never going to be. Oh, and those announcements and the dedications, you see Comedy Day? Oh, those dedications were so great. And those announcements, I mean, they're a necessary evil, but they're not entertaining. It's just, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah,
it's just a fact.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're, I guess if you're at the level of Bob Dylan, any kind of like farcical parody you're going to do with footage is going to involve like legends, you know, like, yeah. even if this was a 5-minute like movie, it would have still involved like Richie Havens, Joni Mitchell, you know, like, mm-hmm. like the best of the best, you know?
Yeah. I didn't expect to see Jimmy Carter in this. That was weird.
That's right.
He plays a mean guitar. I did not know that smoke where that. He does all along the Watchtower when he's in that room with Hendrix. You gotta watch this. It's a crazy documentary.
You gotta watch it.
And it might have been CGI.
His brother is there. Yeah.
I mean, there are obviously actors in this. And people who are playing different parts, like they actually get the Paramount CEO to do a part in this, which is like he's not busy enough, I guess. Like he could, but it's Marty Scorsese. He gave me a call. I sat down and I made up some bullshit.
It'll take 5 minutes, John. Come on.
Yeah. I think that's pretty insane. And like and he's believable. He's like a pretty good actor too. Like I believed it before I found out that most of this shit was fake. And then Michael Murphy, who plays Congressman Jack Turner, the guy that talks to the president.
So I didn't know that was fake.
Yeah.
Fake. That's fake.
Tell me what else is fake.
The fact that he thinks that he says he got the idea for Make It From Kiss, I thought was hilarious.
That was, yeah.
I'm like, that is just friggin' great.
That I assumed. The photo looked like a little photoshopped.
Yeah, but I was like, that is so good. They're making this kind of funny. And like, you know, like, Dylan, kind of a serious guy, not taking himself too seriously where he doesn't even, you know, like.
That part I really enjoyed because I always figure like Dylan's the kind of guy that just like masturbates while looking into a mirror. Like he just loves himself. And to see him being a little like tongue in cheek, you know, especially at the beginning when he's like, wait, that was bullshit. Like, let me try that over again. He's like, that sounded horrible.
There's some the stuff that what's his name? Letterman's musician.
Paul Schaefer.
Paul Schaefer wrote a bunch of stuff about Dylan. I think it might be for the Biograph. It's fascinating how all Dylan wanted is to meet Larry Bud Melman. He was just the biggest Larry Bud Melman fan. So he's just like, he's like not doing great during all the run-throughs. He doesn't really care. He's giving it like 20%. And then the Neither Show, he does great. He's like, wow, I was so surprised. Like, I never really understood what you did on this show, you know? I just wanted to meet Larry Bud Melman. Now I kind of get it. But, like, it's just weird. Like, there's this interview with him with a British journalist. It might have been an outtake from Don't Look Back, where he's talking to this British guy. I think it's on a train or in his dressing room. And he's so clearly coked up. And he's like, and the guy's saying, hey, I met a guy named Bob Dylan. And Bob Dylan's like, oh, man, that's crazy. It's like, what do you do when you meet someone named after you? I mean, what? You know, he's like at his worst of being like a doped up rock star. So I'd suggest looking at that, reading this Paul Schaefer stuff. It's just so hard to get a sense of like, does he take himself seriously or is he just so? I think he just goes in phases, and I think sometimes he does take himself, and sometimes he whatever his focus on, you know.
Yeah.
I just think he's an odd cat who just, you know, he just has all these different phases.
Well, didn't he say he was from New Mexico for a while and he's from Minnesota? Like
he's documented. Kind of he's from Hebbing, Minnesota, you know, mm-hmm. that he got into Jewishness for a while. Then he rejects that and goes into Christianity. You know, I don't know if he's ever actually left that, but his music has moved on. Mm-hmm. You know, then every like 10 albums is it's like critically acclaimed as a comeback.
Right, you know, right.
These sparse albums.
Who else was in the Wallflowers? I forget. Who else was in that?
The Wallflowers was, you mean Traveling Wilburys?
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm, yeah, Traveling Wilburys.
Wallflowers.
That was George Harrison, Jeff Lynne, Roy Orbison.
Yeah.
Jeff Lynne.
Tom Petty.
Jesus. Leave anybody out?
Yeah. That's it. Yeah, you know, just those guys.
Yeah. That's a pretty, and they kind of suck, though, right? I mean, they had like one hit.
They had some catchy stuff, but yeah, Handle Me With Care. But it's just a little catchy, but you know, it's anything with too many chefs is never, it's like, you ever see, you right. go to a great concert and they all jam at the end, it's never the best part of the concert. It's always like,
oh
yeah, it's a noodle fest or Johnny Be Good or some bloated version. It's fun, and there you see everybody up there, right. But it's not, you know, and I think it's very middle of the road,
dude.
That album, you know, I think two albums they did actually.
Do you guys remember the scene where Joan Baez is doing her weird snake dance?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was like, I've never seen any footage of Joan Baez like loosening up like that.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's why she doesn't really dance.
Yes. Like kind of a Steven Tyler crouch. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, very, yeah. Very I thought odd. It was funny when she says, when you see him on stage, all is forgiven. I think that tells you a lot about Bob Dylan. Mm. When you see him sing, all is forgiven, you know?
Mm, yeah.
Just must have been a handful.
What was the white face all about? What was that? I don't know what that is.
I think it was some French movie. He said he just wanted to like be a minstrel, you know, go back to the traveling gypsy.
I'm glad he
show.
Went that direction. Yeah. I'm going to do the white face. I'm
like, I could have gone horribly wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan is canceled, you know?
Yeah.
And then they pick really small venues. I thought that was pretty cool, actually. They pick these tiny fucking venues in New England and just surprising the fuck out of some Massachusetts people, you know? I thought that was kind of an interesting angle.
Yeah, I think it was before rock and roll got real down to a business where there's a template for how you do things, you know, like Live Nation or Bill Graham probably institutionalized things that just everybody does now, you know? And it was before that when you had that and then... you know, you had around the same time he did The Last Waltz was, I don't know if that was 76, so not too soon after that. And that, Bill Graham lost a ton of money on, they served everybody Thanksgiving dinner. Like, you know, like, I don't think they do that anymore.
Well, Bill Graham was in this for a second, right?
I don't know if he, yeah, maybe Bill for Graham a second. I don't
know. Yeah. They served everyone Thanksgiving dinner. What does that mean?
During The Last Waltz, they served everybody turkey dinner at the
audience or the musicians?
Yeah. Everybody.
Oh fuck.
Yeah. That's I'm sure crazy. The musicians got different than the guy in 136B, but
yeah. Right.
That's pretty crazy. You know, it's a special like, you know, it's and my uncle went. They were living in Sacramento, came down to my grandma's where we're all getting. He's like, "Well, I got to go. I'm going to go see Bob." I was like, even at that age, I'm like, "You're so lucky going to see Bob Dylan, you know." And he came back. I just thought he was lying. And everybody came out, the band was, I was like, "Come on."
Neil Young.
Yeah, crazy. With a famous cocaine booger. If you watch it's been digitally, you gotta YouTube it. It's famous. Or Google it. Like, yeah, he had a
did
big
you just
white,
say cocaine booger?
I did say cocaine. Okay. One of the few times I've used that phrase in my
it's
life.
It's not something we've ever had on this show. That's
I was
awesome.
Born a little too late. but yeah, and they had to pixelate it out for the remastering of The Last Waltz.
Okay, let's recap this. That's a lot to take in.
Scorsese does fuck with stuff. Yeah, he does CGI stuff.
Oh, he does. So wait, in the original concert footage of The Last Waltz, shot in San Francisco at...
The Warfield.
Oh, was
at
it?
At the Warfield.
I think it's the Warfield, yeah.
Okay. You can see cocaine in Neil Young's nostril.
Yes.
Like
yes.
remnants.
Yes.
Oh,
I am,
wow.
I am awesome. Swearing to the Senate subcommittee, yes, you can.
Summer 1975, rumor came around that the inspired Dylan was back, gathering all of his forces.
The idea was to put a tour up.
We should be playing 20,000 seats, but instead, he wanted all these small venues.
We're really running short of time. I want to introduce Bob Dylan.
Boy, sure hope we get to Boston on time. Where you
been? The tour was a catastrophe. Where
you been? It wasn't a success.
Not if you measure success in terms of profit.
The nation was so divided. So they embarked on a journey through America.
Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, and Jack Elliott, right in the Civic Center.
You know me, I'm too old for that kind of stuff.
Oh.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Now okay. as non-Dylan fans, you guys both watched it, right?
Yeah.
What did you think as it just as form of like... sorry to turn the table. Like, because I'm just curious, like... I put it up like, yeah, another crazy thing Bob Dylan's doing that's kind of cool. I put on the cool side of things. What did you guys think as non-Dylan fans, just as people who like documentaries?
I wrote to Paco like at like 1 a.m. the other day. I'm like, this is so long. I stopped. I'm like, there's another hour and a half.
Yeah, it's long. Yeah.
I'm like, what? What am I? What?
And you could just skip past once the song starts if you know, because a lot of it's just whole songs.
I like the songs, actually. I did like the songs, but I'm just like, what is. I thought I was just, my brain was going crazy because I didn't know what was real at all. Like, I was convinced like there was overdubs happening and stuff like that. Yeah. I didn't know what was going on.
If I fast forwarded
to some of the songs I didn't like just to the end of the song because I was like, well, I'm not going to learn anything if I don't, you know.
Right.
So it was a little shorter because it could drag, and plus it's like the old concert production values where everything's kind of like locked black and not the best, you know.
I love the violin player.
Oh, Scarlett Riviera. She's all over the album Desire, and that's about it. She's not on anything after or anything before.
That, I want to doc just about her. I was like, oh, you could have made a film just about her.
Yeah,
let's play Pitch a Duck.
And I didn't even know what was true about her. Like, people say she was Gene Simmons' girlfriend, but I'm like, I don't know if that's true or not. You know, is that just another thing? You know,
I think that was amazing.
God, I hope not. This is a good segue because we do a game called Pitch a Duck or Doc Hollywood or whatever we want to call it, where there's a story you've heard that's true that you've always wanted to see as a documentary. So. George just kind of got us in there with the documentary about the violinist, which would be awesome. She seems really particular. I mean, I feel like she could have played in Zappa's band or
she
something.
She seems,
you know?
To me, being from San Francisco, like a classic ex-girlfriend.
Yes.
A little interesting, but more nuts than interesting. Yeah. And you're like, oh, she's cool, but like, yeah, you know.
You know, I just thought of, what have you guys seen that documentary about Thoth? Do you know about that guy?
No.
So there's a documentary.
How do you spell that?
T-H-O-T-H. He was a guy that was around.
Oh, Top 0.0.
He was around San Francisco. He would like play in Golden Gate Park or UC Berkeley, like wearing like a loincloth playing violin. And there's there's a really interesting documentary about him that actually I think was like nominated for an Oscar, actually.
Oh, really?
Maybe 2002 or something.
I gotta
like
check
that
out.
Yeah, yeah. So made me think of that, but that's not what I was gonna pitch. Did you guys come up with pitches? I got one. Do you guys got one?
I have one. Mm-hmm.
I don't have one. I thought someone should do a good documentary. It's not a story. It's a profile on R. Crumb. I think
maybe Terry Zweigoff should do one.
The time is right. Yeah, he would be great.
Yeah,
he would be great. And then
awesome.
Following that, the Civil War. I mean, no one's really... those two things, I know things have been done about it, but not to my satisfaction.
Yeah, that would be, I would like to see the pictures get like really small, then really
great
big.
Great idea. Just,
yeah, thank
well,
you.
Well, you guys do thank this, you. So you can recognize a good idea when you hear one.
Yeah.
But I know this is dumb and easy to think, but I thought the same thing could be applied. Like, why don't they do that? Since it's a more pivot or equally pivotal about a revolution, a real good Revolutionary War documentary slash George Washington. Like, I don't, maybe he was boring, but like we have Lincoln, it seems like we have a lot of Lincoln stuff, but like a real thorough Washington slash Revolutionary War one, I think would be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
I'm sure
so.
There's stuff out there, but I'm not aware of something that's like gone viral or
one
like,
of my favorite Washington stories is how he duped the fucking English, the British army by being like, yeah, I'll see you in the morning for our fight. And then they leave in the Hudson.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
use the fog to take off. And he's just like, fuck you guys.
That's great.
Yeah, I love that.
That could be in
that's
there.
Nice.
Other stuff he yeah. did. Cherry tree. Yeah,
some
know,
other
boom.
Stuff.
Rice itself.
Yeah.
Wig.
Yeah. Some
wouldn't
wig
he?
Stuff. Yep, absolutely. I was reading the other day about a guy in the 50s, a white guy, who dressed up as a black guy and got rode Greyhound buses for a long time.
Oh, Green Bus.
Huh?
It's called Green Bus would be the name of that documentary.
The green tortoise.
Okay, it could be Green Bus, yeah.
No, Green Mile.
Green Mile.
Green Bus Mile. He rode the Greyhound bus for like months and then wrote a book about racism. And he got so many death threats, he had to move to Mexico.
Wow, that's interesting. What's his name? What's his name or name of this work?
It's not, there is no name. It's just, I just read about him. And I just think it'd be an interesting documentary.
Yeah, that would be a good one.
And then it would just be him being like, I regret doing all of that. I wish people hadn't.
Want to move to Mexico.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you guys do this not for a living, but as a passion, this documentary stuff. And it's when you watch, there's been a few that change your worldview. Where you're just like, oh, the world is not what I thought it was. One is the Captured in Plain Sight. The other one is like the Art of Killing, where you're just like, oh boy,
yeah.
I thought I had things kind of figured out, and I don't at all. There is some weird stuff going on in this world, and I'm sure just as weird stuff's happening right now someplace. But there where you just watch them and they haunt you, you know, for like this Dylan one's a fun pop culture thing, and it you know, if it gets more people turned on to Dylan or that especially that period, which I think is an interesting period, that's great. But it's like some of these documentaries, you're just like, holy crap, you know?
Yeah, actually, I like that there was like some scenes that contextualize the time period.
Yeah,
I'm not super cognizant of that, like what the actual timing would have been. Like, oh wait, someone is that when someone tries to kill Gerald Ford? It's like right after Watergate.
Yeah.
All of that stuff.
It's the post hippie euphoria of Woodstock era, kind of now, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also looking to the baby boomer generation, which is like as we get older and can look back and with hindsight, it's like you guys were kind of idiots, you know, the baby boomers.
Yeah, totally.
You know, it's like the baby boomers took themselves so fucking seriously, and the older I get, the more I look back at baby boomers, just like you guys fucked up everything and wanted to save everything, but and kind of fucked up everything, you know.
Well, it became ultimately like self-indulgent, I think, where it's just like, we want to do this, but it's not comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
It's like,
yeah.
But, you know, like, it's because those are our parents, really, you know, like.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
I just picture like the Whole Foods parking lot in Berkeley, like someone's bumper sticker, like visualize world peace. Trying to run you over for just being in their way.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, on a very, very expensive, like on a Tesla, like coexist on a, you know, on a fucking SUV or something.
Very Marin, very Marin.
So I think this period's almost like an intersection of those 60s values and the baby boomer post that coming, you know, self-indulgence coming in. Like you could say it's the way they've had the makeup is a little self-indulgent, or is it art, or, you know, it's like that weird crossroads of like.
Yeah, you could say this whole thing, this whole tour is self-indulgent because it lost money.
Yeah.
It was basically Dylan being like, I want to bring some people. I want to freak out some squares in the Northeast.
I want to freak out some squares.
Right?
Yeah.
That's kind of.
Yeah,
man. Freak out some squares. It's probably a little late to freak out
some
squares.
Blow some smoke in their stupid monkey faces. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's also weird when you see, like, would see people handing out flyers for a Bob Dylan show when you say, hey, Bob Dylan's in town. Do you want to go to a Bob Dylan?
And not for me.
Yeah, not for me. Thanks. And you're like, well, I guess that's before the internet where you just post something and then 2 seconds later, Chappelle's doing the punchline, sold out.
Yeah.
You just have to like, oh, even Bob Dylan has to flyer.
Dude, I've handed out handbills in my generation, in my lifetime. And I'm like, oh, yeah, like it would be if I had anyone that anyone recognized as much as Bob Dylan, people at least take the flyer.
Yeah.
I'd be like, here, no, just take the flyer. There's like a MySpace on it. You got to come to the thing.
Do you think is Barking Dead?
I do, man. It barely works, but
When you do it, is it like, I know in New York they still did it when I lived there. But I don't know if they Times Square. I bet they still do. The B clubs have to get people in,
right? Like I remember hearing like Aziz Ansari had to do that to get stage time. You had to hand out flyers.
Yeah, and there's
and
some
stuff.
Clubs who are just rely on it more than others. But you can't used to not. I had to walk to Times Square to get to my job, and every day it's like stand up comedy, mm-hmm. and from Letterman, from Comedy Central, they would be none of those people on the show that night. But they just have to, they might stop by.
They're in town.
They're in New York City.
Well, I bark for a free show, so I feel like it's like...
Where do even people bark in L.A.?
Well, on Sawtelle.
Oh, okay.
There's actually foot traffic. But, like, people are there like, no thanks, I don't want to see comedy. I'm just here for noodles, you know?
Right.
So it's a little bit harder. Oh, I did want to talk about my pitch a doc, which is this guy Shane Morris had an amazing flame out on Twitter in the last month. He basically posted this really long thread about how he went on a road trip with a van.
And, oh, I read about this.
Yeah. And he claimed that there was a brick of heroin inside of the van and that it actually belonged to a guy from MS-13. And he hornswoggled these guys from MS-13.
You should pause for people can Google hornswoggle right now.
Okay, let's just take a break.
This is not a moment. It sounds like
Am I a boomer? What
are
fuck
you, Amish?
Yeah. The English hornswoggled. So it turned out very clear. I mean, I kind of went along with it, just like this is entertaining. He had made up the entire thing, and then he went on social media. I think he went like on Medium. Is like, wow, I just want to say I made up that whole thing because people have been telling me, you shouldn't say that you ripped off MS-13. People will come and find you. So he got off. His Twitter account got suspended. He started a GoFundMe so him and his wife could go into hiding from MS-13. I'm like, now I don't know if that's real now. Because what, like, the entire thing. And then I found out also, I had read something of his earlier because he had written a post about Lil Nas X and how about Nashville. He'd worked in, like, record labels, so how Nashville was racist. So then all the anti-Shane Morris truther people are like country music people that are defending country music. There's like so much going on with this one guy who I think maybe used to write for Grantland or something, but just like found Twitter fame right away and then just like, nope, got to shut this off.
And also, didn't he get like tons of offers or something to write?
Yeah, I think because of that initial thread, people were like, you should write a screenplay of this.
Well, my wife heard about it at Brooklyn Nine-Nine and they said like he got all these offers from agents, because now agents aren't a thing, I guess. But he got all these offers to write
a screenplay based on his made-up story.
He got, or meetings at least. He got a lot of meetings.
I bet he got some meetings.
I think that's what it was. He got tons of meetings. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yet another scammer. Another internet scammer.
That's insane. But that's the kind of thing that could go viral, these little stories or many things that someone games the system kind of, and they go, and that's like a new form of entertainment now.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's bad because
this is based on a true story.
Yeah.
Guys.
Yeah. It's the same thing. Only it's like a DIY thing. It's like, I'm going to do my own Fargo. And that's what it is.
It is like a Fargo of social media. It's like, then I crossed the gang. Oh no. Now I have to get off of Twitter.
So yeah. I say more power.
That
to
should
him.
Be season 4 of Fargo. It's a Shane Morris story. They just make it a guy who rips off the bad guy on Twitter. Be like, but did I really?
Yeah, the guys are like,
go
okay,
to my GoFundMe.
What happened now? Okay.
Then MS-13 is like tweeting back at them. Yeah. So
that's awesome. So I think that is a great place to end. I think that's a nice bow we just put on.
And we
that.
Technically that's... talked about the movie twice.
Yeah. We at least did twice. Talk about the movie.
Do your Marty Scorsese.
I can't do him. I can't do him. I got. I get it.
I have a sequel for After Hours I want to make, Marty.
What's it called?
It's called Early Dawn.
Already been in Hong Kong movie. Already been done. Sorry, I can't do it. I can't do anything more.
I like the cheese bit. I think that was.
I'll work
Martin
on that.
Martin Scorsese as the worst roommate ever.
So Paco, I hope to see you in a couple of weeks. When I'm up there with Arj, are you around?
Let's talk some dates here. What are you talking? Give us some dates.
This is gonna be
July 3rd through the 7th, but no show on the 4th.
No one wants to do a show on the 4th.
With Arj and my friend Karen Anderson, since it's a special occasion, she's coming out of retirement to open for us. So that'll be a fun week. Molly moved it from the Cobbs to the Punchline since it was closing. So,
So you will be at Cobbs?
No, Punchline. It's normally every year in summer I come with Arj to Cobbs. She's shifted it over since it might be the last hurrah. So that'll be
fun. You and Arj Barker at San Francisco Punchline July
3rd, 5th, and 6th.
That's awesome. I will be there. I am in town.
Yeah, maybe a hike on the 4th or something, huh?
For
a hike or something?
Yeah, take a hike. Maybe go to Mount Cam or something.
All right, well, thanks for having me on, you guys.
Thank you, Tony Kameen. Catch him. Where else can people find you? Are you on the Twitters? Are you on the Instas?
I have it, but I never go on Twitter. Facebook.
IMDb.
I'll be at the American Comedy Club next week if this airs in time. And then Punchline the following week in San Francisco.
Yeah.
My beloved San Francisco.
Yeah.
George, where can people find
you? Yeah, George. I want to come to your open mic. I love it.
Yeah, come to my open mic. Edendale Library, Thursday, 6 p.m.
A little early for the Townster.
Sorry. I also have my Mid-City show at Real Plain Fine Arts on third Saturdays. I have my first Thursday show at Giant Robot on Sawtell. But we are taking July 4th off also. Wow. We do not want to compete with all the free fireworks in the sky. So
sure.
What about you, Paco?
Paco, what do you got to promote? Where are you?
For myself, I will be at the Laughs Unlimited June 27th. You can come see me. I'll be featuring at Rooster Tea Feathers in July, the end of July, July 24th through the 28th or something like that. And proudly, I am headlining a show at Shakespeare's Lowell Level Comedy Club in Kalamazoo, Michigan on July 20th. My hometown. I'm coming back, folks. Mama, there goes that man. Tony, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, fellas.
Thank you for coming on.
And thanks for making me watch that thing. I don't know if I would have watched it, and I'm glad I did. Because I would have put it off and I would have back burner. Like, I'll get to that someday. Yeah. But, you know, you guys put a fire under my ass, so thanks.
Perfect. Thank you, sir.
Hey, thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com.
We've been recapping reality since 2015.
Our theme song was written by David Siegel, and our show was engineered by Will Scoville.
For as little as $1 a month, you can donate to this show through our Patreon page, patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
If you want to help us out in other ways, please share the show with friends. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
Find out more about Paco and George's comedy gigs on the About Us page on our website.
SupDoc is by doc fans for doc fans. So if you want to advertise with SupDoc, got a film you want to recommend, or any opinions, please hit us up.
Email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.